From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, WUWM education reporter Emily Files joins us to go over some of the Republican-authored education bills advancing through Wisconsin state legislature.
AB 411 and bills like it are a poor attempt at reverse psychology to sow seeds of division and hate by playing on the fears of a shrinking white majority.
We'll learn about the rise of human trafficking during the pandemic, then hear from two local moms that started a podcast to share their experiences of raising transgender children.
The greatest advice I can give a parent is keep having a conversation with it. Okay, what does that mean to you? What can I do to support you? What would you like?
Plus, Bubbler Talk looks into two seemingly random brick pillars on Milwaukee's east side. Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. We'll start with the Republican-authored education bills advancing through Wisconsin state legislature. One of the bills that has gotten the most attention is related to the national debate over so-called critical race theory. There are a number of other bills that add mandates for teachers or that push for more transparency from schools. It's important to note that if and when these bills pass through the Republican-controlled Assembly and Senate, they go to Democratic Governor Tony Evers, who can veto them. WUWM education reporter Emily Files is here to bring us up to speed on the GOP education agenda as shown through these bills. So, Emily, what are the themes you've been seeing here?
One of the major themes has to do with preventing alleged indoctrination of students in the K-12 classroom by either prohibiting teachers from teaching certain things or by requiring schools to be more transparent about what they're teaching. One of the bills requires public schools to post the materials they're using in classrooms on the homepage of their websites. It also allows school district residents to take legal action against schools if they're not complying with this rule. Both the Assembly and Senate passed this bill on party line floor votes last week. I have a clip from Representative Elijah Banky, a Republican from Oconto, who authored the bill.
The one good thing that came out of COVID-19 is that it allowed parents to get a sneak peek into the children's classrooms and see what was being taught. However, in far too many cases, this showed us the true indoctrination of our children. There's a difference between teaching our children about controversial topics and forcing ideological viewpoints.
So that bill is headed to the governor now, but because it's opposed by Democrats and school districts, Evers is unlikely to sign it.
You said preventing classroom indoctrination seems to be a theme of the Republican legislation this session. So what other bills speak to that?
You can see that theme also with the bill aimed at critical race theory, which, by the way, the bill does not include the term critical race theory in its text. It's part of a national conservative movement that uses CRT as a catch-all term against anti-racism efforts in schools. Basically, parents and politicians who are concerned with schools going too far with diversity, equity, and inclusion. Speaker Robin Voss said in a press conference last week that the bill is about preventing teachers from stereotyping people based on their race or sex.
That seems to me to be something that should be, again, for people who went to civics and understand what America stands for. We should be a colorblind society that judges everybody based on the content of their character, as somebody much more eloquent than me said, than on the color of their skin.
Democrats are fiercely opposed to this bill. They're worried about it having a chilling effect on teachers, who they say need to be able to have honest conversations about racism, both in historical contexts and in the present day. Here's Milwaukee Representative Lakeisha Myers at a press conference before Assembly Republicans passed the bill.
AB 411 and bills like it are a poor attempt at reverse psychology to sow seeds of division and hate by playing on the fears of a shrinking white majority.
There's also a bill that would potentially restrict school lessons on gender identity and sexual orientation as well. Where does that legislation stand?
That bill hasn't made it to a floor vote yet, but it certainly follows along with the theme of fear over progressive indoctrination in schools. it would allow parents to opt their students out of lessons related to sexual orientation, gender, gender identity, or gender expression. Evers' office has outright said he would veto this bill.
So what other education bills might be headed to Governor Evers' desk soon?
Two more that are aimed at increasing school transparency or accountability. One of them requires DPI to create a school district financial information portal that would allow taxpayers easier access to school spending information. That one passed both the Senate and Assembly last week. The other transparency-related bill would require schools to report the number of students who take a credit recovery course. Then there are two bills that are more along the lines of teaching mandates. One would require civics education for graduation. The other requires cursive instruction.
So realistically, do you think Evers will sign any of those bills?
The civics education and cursive bills do have some scattered support from Democrats, but they're not broadly bipartisan bills.
Okay, so far we've touched upon school indoctrination, more transparency of lessons and spending for parents to see, critical race theory, even cursive. Anything else on the Republican legislative agenda that you want to mention?
Yeah, one more thing I'm watching. There's been a growing movement to improve how schools teach kids to read. Brain science shows that explicit, systematic phonics instruction, which is helping kids understand how letters translate into sounds, that is really effective, especially for kids with dyslexia. But that's not how all schools teach kids to read. And it's true that in Wisconsin, reading achievement has stagnated. Only 36% of Wisconsin fourth graders are proficient readers, according to a national assessment. So Republicans want to hold schools more accountable. The bill circulating right now on that would increase the number of times students are screened for reading difficulties. Schools would then need to come up with intervention plans for students who score poorly, and they would need to notify parents. This bill shows reading is an issue Republicans are going to continue to push, with support from dyslexia advocates and others who say schools need to do better for struggling readers. And in fact, the new state superintendent of public instruction, Jill Underley, is planning her own review of reading issues. She announced during her State of Education address that she was forming a literacy task force to help restore Wisconsin's standing as a national leader on literacy. The details of that task force are still to be determined.
All right. Well, certainly sounds like a busy legislative session on the education front. So, Emily, thanks for the rundown.
Thanks, Audrey.
Emily Files is WUWM's education reporter. You can find more information about some of the bills we talked about, as well as her other education coverage, at WUWM.com. Milwaukee has long been considered a hub of human trafficking in the United States, specifically sex trafficking. Sex traffickers often target vulnerable girls and women, trapping them in a life that can be difficult to escape. For years, Dana World Patterson has been helping exploited women leave that life behind. As the founder and CEO of Foundations for Freedom, she educates and supports formerly trafficked women and girls. Now, Foundations for Freedom has embarked on a new chapter, providing housing for these same women. World Patterson spoke to Lake Effect's Joy Powers about it in July.
When we're talking about this kind of housing, why is it important to have emergency housing that is specifically dedicated to formerly trafficked people?
It's imperative to have housing that is dedicated to women who have fled sex trafficking. One, because many of the women that we have experienced are not looking for a hand out, but a hand up. And if they are still in need of money or in the space where their finances are not fluid enough for them to have housing that is not deplorable, it is essential. And we have this mindset as we have continued to move and to learn about housing in our city. What I was finding as I was taking the women around that needed housing, that the amount of money that they needed to spend, that they could afford to spend, kept them in a space of landlords that didn't care as much about their housing and their properties. I saw that more than I would care to number or to even share. So it really began to put the pieces together when 6 years ago, I saw just a beautiful white bathroom. And with that, I just held on to it thinking, oh, Foundations for Freedom, Inc. will eventually be in the housing market. And now here we are 6 years later in this space and in between working with the women and not having enough money, Joy, where they could meet staying in a wonderful home that would allow them to rest their head and to think differently. It kept, I call, that monkey on their back, where either they were going to spend the money for housing and then have to think about how they were going to make ends meet or live in these deplorable conditions and have a sense of at least I can buy groceries and maybe a pair of shoes or things that they would desire or need. So it's just important, beyond essential, that we are in this space. And I'm looking forward to even having more housing because the need is that great.
Well, that speaks to the vulnerability of a lot of these people and part of how many people end up being trafficked to begin with. Have you seen situations where a lack of stable housing has led to people being trafficked?
I won't say that I have seen that cart before the horse, but the word that you used, vulnerability, is the thread that I've seen the most. Individuals that are vulnerable, and that comes in many different ways, but individuals that are vulnerable are more likely to fall into the grips of a trafficker, either through force, fraud, and coercion on the streets or however they're going to be a part of this horrific enterprise called human trafficking, human sex trafficking in particular.
Yeah. A question I had just about how this kind of housing works. How will people end up getting into this housing? How do they access it?
Mm-hmm. Well, we may have to market, but we're just going to reach out to our friends, you know, and those who know the work that we do, because we're not going to have a sign outside the apartment saying, hey, guess who can live here? It's not going to be like that. But our friends will know, and we'll make those connections with individuals that are working with this vulnerable population of women so that, and if they need housing at the time. Now, it's a little different because we're more this particular apartment will be for transition versus emergency. It's not going to be, for instance, where there's a sweep and the women that were part of that sting who need housing will then come to for this program. This will be more for women who have fled. They're working, but there's not enough. And as I said, the monkey is still on their back from time to time. And they, because of the mindset, they understand and they know how they can make $500, $1,000, get their car fixed, things like that, make the ends meet. And we just want to lessen that. We want to bring that to a halt. So in addition to housing, we're also going to wrap around them financial literacy, mindfulness, yoga, things that we do on a regular basis that an individual may take for granted, we want to load the women that we'll come in contact with through housing solutions with these needful things to allow them to think differently and that they can really matriculate into society in a way that they're thriving.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned this is a pretty long time goal of yours, of your organization's. What do you think the future holds? What do you want to see next?
Oh my goodness. I am looking forward to several transitional homes where women have already fled. And now, you know, just needing that wraparound service, just that you can do it. Then we're also looking for emergency housing where through the sweeps that an individual has already made up in their mind that, pardon my French, I'm not a hoe. You know, this just isn't me. So thank you for this rescue. Thank you for this sting. I've been waiting for someone to come, right? Through that process that will be there and have a beautiful house where they can lay their head. And then again, the unwrapping of the force, fraud, and coercion. And thirdly, the girls. The girls need also a place to stay, 13 being the average age that girls are sex trafficked. Again, something shouldn't be. But home is not always the best place. And that is very important for our listeners, your listeners to know, going home is not always the best place for that to be their only option. Where we know that going home is not their best option, I am so excited to say that we are also thinking about and working on, and we know that it will be in time. I wanted it to be in this first phase, but we're going to have an amazing housing unit this first time around, get our feet wet, and then continue to grow into the spaces that are in my heart, the visions that we see for the city of Milwaukee and even going into other states. So I'm super excited about the possibilities, because when you consider that, when you consider sex trafficking, 80% are women, 50% are children, more people should roll up their sleeves that really care, not just because you can, but that really care about the eradication of sex trafficking and moving an individual from victimization through survival to thriving. That's our lineage. Just to move a person to a place of being their absolute best without that stench of smoke. It's said that an individual may come in and out of the life 5 to 16 times. Those numbers are sad because we know so much can happen between 5 to 16 times of going in and out. So no, we have to roll up our sleeves and do more. We have to care. That's our endeavor. We want to do as much as we can to eradicate sex trafficking, to get that monkey off of an individual's back. And we know that trans women, men, and boys also need the assistance, but we're going to do all we can for the women and the girls that we serve.
What is your advice when you see people who may be in need in this way?
Mm-hmm. I listen to the hair standing up on the back of my neck. I listen to my gut. I think that first connecting with their humanity is absolutely imperative. So I'm forever saying, hey, sis, hey, hi. You know, if we have the opportunity, what's your name? For instance, I was in a known track over the weekend and I saw her when I went down the busy street. I came around because she was by herself and she looked fresh. You know, she didn't look old and used up. She looked fresh. And I came around and I was like, hey, how you doing, sis? She said, I'm good. I said, what's going on? She said, nothing. And then I heard, tonk, tonk, a honk. What does that say to me? Keep her moving, right? But I connected with her in her eyes. I said, hello. You know, and if she would have given me more conversation, I would have taken that opportunity. But oftentimes, I remember being in New York, and I had a little more time with an individual. And she said, you know, no one has ever asked me my name. I saw her then years later And Total Recall, I was amazed. And I called her by name. She turned around. She said, "You remember me?" I said, "I remember you." She was in another area, you know, and but now this time I was more aware and I could see the person in the cut. You know, I could see them watching her and our conversation. So in the same way, the woman that I saw over the weekend, that honk, honk, you never know who's watching. I continued on, but that was one touch. That was that one touch. So if this person lives in your neighborhood, hey, hi, that's it. Make the connection with the person. Not that you're, maybe the long run is the coming, fleeing, but to connect with a person, looking them in their eyes, saying hello, that goes a long way, a long, long way. And the woman in New York, I said, "What you need, sis?" She said, "Nothing." She said, "I'm going to get so many hot dogs and stuff out here, nothing. Will you pray for me?" I said, "You got it." And guess what? I kept moving because I saw the person watching. I don't want her to get beat up. I don't want that to be her last day on the earth. You know, I kept moving. So just say hello, just connect.
All right. Well, Dana, I can't thank you enough for sharing your work with us. And thanks for everything you do.
Joy, thank you.
Dana World Patterson is the founder and CEO of Foundations for Freedom. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about the organization's new housing for formerly trafficked women in July. Coming up in about 20 minutes, the latest Bubbler Talk explores two brick pillars on Milwaukee's east side and finds out why they might be there. But first, in our series with the Milwaukee Public Library, we'll bring you a new book recommendation about climate change. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Every month, we'll be highlighting a Milwaukee public librarian in our new series with the Milwaukee Public Library. Today, we'll be hearing from Kelly Bolter. She was previously the branch manager at the Tippecanoe Library and now works at Central as a library services manager and helps lead the monthly Climate Action Book Club. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang about the book club and this month's recommendation from author J. Drew Lanham.
Thank you so much, Kelly, for being here on Lake Effect with me as our October Librarian of the Month. You are the lead librarian that manages the Climate Action Book Club. Could you talk about what this book club is and how and why was it created?
Thank you. And I just want to say how excited I am to talk to you, Mallory. And so the Climate Action Book Club was a creation of a grant that MPL received at the beginning of this year for resilient communities, libraries respond to climate change. And the book club was created as a way to have the conversation around climate change and climate issues within our various communities in Milwaukee, facilitated by the library, but also more importantly, as a way to amplify voices of color in these conversations. Very often, white voices tend to dominate conversations around climate change and climate action. And so it's important for the library to serve as a place where, you know, everyone's welcome, everyone's represented, and also promote our, obviously, our values of literacy and connecting with everyone, as many people as possible within the city of Milwaukee for a stronger, healthier Milwaukee.
As the Librarian of the Month for October, what book are you recommending?
So I thought quite a bit about this. The book that has spoken the most to me is the one that we did for August called The Home Place by Dr. J. Drew Lanham. It's a memoir by Dr. Lanham. He is a Black ornithologist who lives in South Carolina. And he talks about growing up there. His grandmother represented, in contrast with his parents, who were educators, she represented sort of like the spirit world, you know, kind of like this balance of looking at the environment with scientific viewpoint, but then also appreciating the magic that is nature. And he talks about his experiences as a Black ornithologist in a field that's so dominated by white men. You know, he calls himself the rarity. And so his experiences in the South also conducting field experiments. He gives one example of basically he's got to stop every half mile to record all of the birds that he hears, you know, as being present in certain locations. And he stops at one point and looks up, and directly across from his vehicle is this huge Confederate flag. And he's like, that's uncomfortable. I wonder if, you know, they're the kind of people who are displaying this as like my heritage sort of attitude versus I'm going to come after you. And so that fear that he feels in, you know, as a scientist, you know, he's like, I'm doing my job. I'm, you know, stewarding the land in this experiment, but then also being fearful of the people he might encounter. The way that Dr. Lanham writes just grabs you and you feel right there with him. It's so immediate and it's so thoughtful. All of our choices have an impact on the environment, you know, whether that is wildlife displacement, you know, and the more subtle impacts that you might have with vegetable farming and agriculture. I cannot recommend it enough.
So could you talk a bit about the book club? What kinds of conversations does the space foster?
The book club is held the last Monday of each month, typically at 6 p.m. Central Time. Participants can register at mpl.org. You know, we see these very real occurrences of change that have these really detrimental impacts on our environment. And, you know, you can see this play out in a number of ways. The book club runs a gamut of genres and titles and voices. And I really, you know, I'm so proud of all the staff that have been involved with it. You know, they've done such a great job too of ensuring that, you know, we read a variety of voices and we're considering a variety of backgrounds and, you know, trying to understand viewpoints and outlooks that, you know, we might not personally experience ourselves, but you know, it's so important to be able to connect with others. Because we're all interconnected, you know, which I know it sounds a little cliche, but you know, that's so true. Humans have an impact on the environment, and the environment is responding now, you know, these disasters that are happening in real time. And so it's our responsibility to be respectful as stewards of the land and use things appropriately and respectfully.
Why is this book club important to you?
This book club is important to me personally because my time at Tippecanoe as the former branch manager. So Tippecanoe Branch Library is considered the green or the eco branch of Milwaukee Public Library. There's a rain garden, bioswales, permeable paving. There's a butterfly garden. A lot of sustainable infrastructure has been built at that branch location. And so I had never worked in a location that featured those types of infrastructure. And it was just so amazing to me to learn about how we can build our spaces, you know, how the library can modify and adapt our spaces to be a more environmentally friendly presence. So like not only enriching people's minds, but hopefully, you know, stewarding and enriching the earth. That I feel just really turned my worldview on its head. And so when I was asked to take over the book club, I jumped at it. I said yes right away. I was just so excited to learn more about issues in sustainability and, you know, and for myself as a librarian, be able to become more familiar with the literature. I've read so much that I wouldn't ordinarily have read 2 years ago, say, before I was at MPL. And I feel that this is such a great program. This is such a great environment to really connect with others. And one of the great things too about virtual programming is that we can welcome attendees from anywhere. The book club itself in August for our meeting, we had someone tuning in from California. That's been a joy, absolutely.
Thank you so much, Kelly, for being here on Lake Effect with me.
Thank you, Mallory, so much for talking to me. And thank you for featuring me on Lake Effect.
Kelly Bolter is the Library Services Manager at MPL's Central Branch. She also helps lead the monthly Climate Action Book Club. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang. You can learn more about the book club at wuwm.com. Two local parents, Diana and Joy, have children who are transgender. They both supported their children's transition in early elementary school, but they also wanted to offer support to other parents with children who are trans. So they started the podcast Transparently Speaking to help other parents and guardians learn how to help their children be their authentic selves. Ultimately, they want other parents to know they're not alone and that they're learning together. The hosts of the podcast, Diana and Joy, don't use their real names to protect the identities of their children. They spoke with Like Effect's Mallory Chang in August about the podcast. Joy begins by explaining how she and Diana got to know one another.
Diana has been an amazing resource for me, and she was somebody who was answering an email when I found a transgender parent support group. After all of my Googling, as I learned about what was going on with my child and kind of could finally put a language to it in terms of my child being transgender, then I was looking up support groups and I found this support group. And I'm pretty sure that it was Diana who responded via email to me and provided me details about how I could join and when the next meeting was going to be. And throughout all of those engagements, Diana was absolutely essential to providing, you know, her context, experience, and knowledge that really supported me and my family in this journey.
For me, I had considered writing a book. I've helped lots of families navigate their children's transition. And I had so many like little pieces of advice on different aspects of the journey that I thought, well, I'll write a book to put all this kind of advice and knowledge into. And I'm just more of a speaker than a writer. So then at some point I was like, forget that. Let's just do podcast first. And Joy and I had been talking with each other. And I think she brings such a great perspective. And with each of us having a child on a different gender vector, I thought it would be a much stronger podcast to have both of our perspectives and to be a more conversational piece.
You both have unique individual stories with your children about when you knew or had an idea they were trans. Could you both talk through that process of how you noticed that in your children and how did you react?
So my son Clark is 15 now and he transitioned when he was 7. But when he was 3 is the earliest I can remember going to the playground and him telling kids that he was a boy. And I thought it was because he loves superheroes and he loves Star Wars and he just wanted to play with them and that they wouldn't play with him if they thought he was a girl. And there were other little things like he always wore a Superman shirt, Clark Kent. He always wore a Superman shirt. And if people called him Supergirl, he would say, no, I'm Superman. And he was like a super quiet kid that didn't usually speak up. So for the fact that he would speak up without hesitation every time. So there were little signs like that. But when he was 7 is when the Coy Mathis story came out, which she was a girl who was 6, who was transgender and won the right to use the bathroom. And I thought, wait, she knows who she is and she's younger than my son. And thought of all the times where he had been trying to say he was a boy. So I started by opening up the conversation. I didn't want to lead him. So I got a lot of professional advice on like, how do I have this conversation without leading him? And I did it just by saying, you know how I always said like genitals equal, you know, a gender. I'm like, I'm wrong with that. There's so many examples where that's not true. And I kind of left it at that. I talked to him about his name because his birth name was very feminine and he didn't like it. And then I told him, hey, I was watching the news and I heard this story and I told the Coy Mathis story and I explained that it was a girl that they had thought was a boy, but she knew she was a girl in her head and her heart. And he looked at me wide-eyed and said, that's me, except I'm a boy in my head and my heart. So that was kind of where we began. And I went through all the things that he had asked for through the years, like boys' underwear. I'm like, hey, do you want that? I'm like, yeah. I'm like, okay. So we went out and bought it. And that's where I started. All the things he'd kind of mentioned, he wanted his hair cut short. So we went and did that. And we discussed names as a family and just kind of followed his lead.
For me and my daughter, Samantha, who is now 11 and who transitioned at the age of 5, it's interesting because when I look back on it, there were so many kind of indicators in hindsight, But it wasn't until my child actually said to me, "Mommy, why did God make me a boy?" that really made me realize there's something going on here that I didn't understand and that I needed to figure out in order to support my child to be her authentic self. So that was really kind of my trigger. And all these things in hindsight are things like, you know, my daughter wearing very feminine clothes or wanting to wear dresses and high heels and wanting to have long hair and wearing a shirt, you know, on her head as if it were long hair and, you know, flipping her head around so it would touch her shoulders and she could imagine, you know, that she had this long hair. But it really wasn't until she had that language, that really powerful language, that really helped me realize I needed to do some learning and went on this journey to discover what it was to be transgender. And the language Diana talked about of supporting my child with recognizing, hey, in your heart and in your head, you're a girl. So let's support you to be a girl. And as I mentioned, you know, that was quite a journey, you know, of learning about what this means, what are the steps we might consider taking to support that transition in the process, how to think about it as my child is just going to be going to school. How do we want to handle things, you know, with folks who knew us at that point in time and introduce ourselves accordingly, et cetera, et cetera.
Thank you both, Diana and Joy, for sharing your stories as parents and that journey that you both took with your children. The last time I talked with Bryce, the last time that we had a conversation together, he said something that really stuck with me when I interviewed him and Laurie Cook Daniels. Laurie said this, and Bryce also agreed with this as well, with someone in your life transitioning, and with someone in your life transitioning, your entire family and everyone around you in your close circles transition to understand and to really see the world from their perspective and be there as support systems. So for the both of you, how do conversations within your families look like when talking about either of your children transitioning, and how have those conversations gone?
I want to kind of call out that every part of this journey is so individual and unique, right? For the individual themselves, for the families themselves. And I feel so blessed and privileged that in general, my family has been very supportive. For us, one of the things that supported us kind of in confirming our knowledge of, yes, this is what's happening, this is what's going on, is back in 2015, we watched the PBS documentary, Growing Up Trans, and it was so confirming for me to see these other families who were experiencing something similar to what I was observing and experiencing with my child. And it really kind of helped confirm what was going on for us. And we asked our family to watch that. And that was super duper helpful for them to recognize, hey, this isn't just, you know, like us, we're the only people who have experienced this. There's lots of people who have experienced this. Here's what it is. And that was super helpful. And basically even just like ask for kindness and grace in terms of, hey, you may not fully understand this and it's taking us all a while to go through this, but here's what's going on. And please, you know, honor this journey that we're on and be respectful.
So it was mainly a discussion amongst our family, and it was with Clark, you know, so it was kind of like, hey guys, you know what makes somebody a boy or girl? And I will say back then I wasn't as familiar with non-binary. We talked about it's who you say you are. And we had discussions about how we respect everybody. They were so young that there's just like a sponge. So it's like, oh, okay. And then I had to approach school. So for families that have been in his class, I reached out with an email to give them space to kind of read it, process it, and react in their own time and not worry about like, what are they saying or doing in front of us? And I offered like to answer any questions they had. And I wrote the email to reflect what was going on, in the sense that I told them that Clark was more confident than we had ever seen him, happier, just really shining the way as a parent you hope for your kids to be happy and just shine their light. And that's what he was doing.
there is a lot of hoops to jump through to help your children transition and being their authentic selves. So what was that decision-making process like? What was that journey like in deciding and figuring out to help your children transition?
I think for me with Clark, he had expressed himself in a masculine, what society would consider a masculine fashion. I don't know if I'd agree, but you know, Star Wars shoes and superhero shirts and things like that. And so when we told people, many people were like, ah, that makes sense. So the hair, we had actually decided as a family, he had asked about short hair prior to transition. And I always thought he was uncomfortable when people were like, are you a boy or girl? They used to ask him all the time. I think again, because his presentation appeared masculine to society, but he had a feminine name. So he got asked that question a lot. And he always seemed extremely uncomfortable when asked that question. So I thought, well, if you cut your hair short, then they're going to think you're a boy. And I thought that was what was upsetting him, that people would think he was a boy. Obviously I learned that was different. So the social transition is just the clothes they wore. So that was already done. It didn't feel like so much of a decision. It just is what it was just like, okay, like you're telling me who you are and I respect that. And so it was a bit emotional of thinking about anyone hurting him for being who he is. And I had a family member say, well, just wait, don't transition him. You're not ready. And to me, that was like not an option, because for me, he told me who he is. And for me to say, okay, but I'm not ready, did not make sense to me.
When you, Mallory, talk about kind of the hoops to jump through, you know, at the time, I don't think it necessarily feels like hoops, because jumping through hoops sounds like you go through it and you're done. And this process of transitioning and supporting, you know, my child, Samantha, through this, it really is this kind of ongoing process of learning new language to use. That concept of the pronouns and even using a new name is something that takes repetition, and it's a habit to build. I think some of the key hoops, when I think about it, are things that might have felt challenging or felt like something we had to take action around or work through, or things like the fear. Oh my gosh, what does this mean for my child? How do we keep Samantha safe? What's going to happen? Will she have friends in the future when her friends find out, if she continues to want to be disclosed? What does that mean? How does all this work, you know, for her? Formal hoops of changing the name on a birth certificate or in a passport or on a social security card. I mean, these are all the many, many things, and there's many others in terms of the process to support your child and sort of society and accepting your child as the being that they are.
What advice would you give to parents of young children who may think that their child is trans or who are in the process of helping their child transition?
If they have a young child who is desiring to dress a certain way, or just let them be. I'm just a strong believer in following the children's lead. So, you know, finding a way to let them be who they are, meaning wear what they want to wear. I just think affirming them and not making them feel badly for what they want to wear is where I'd start. Now, if you have a child that says, I am a boy, girl, non-binary individual, then my advice for that is say, okay, like just the greatest advice I can give a parent is keep having a conversation with it. Okay, what does that mean to you? What can I do to support you? What would you like? You know, and for younger kids, you have to be a little bit more directed. Okay, is there anything you want to change? How do you feel about your hair? How do you feel about your clothes? How do you feel about your name? And just being affirming on all those issues. Great, let's do it. Sounds good. And just ask them, how do you feel about this?
And so my real advice is to any individuals out there who might be observing a young person or an older person going through this journey of gender identity exploration or discovery or confirmation, like give yourself grace in knowing this is challenging. It's challenging to understand if it's not something you've been through before. Just give yourself some self-compassion and grace on the journey of learning.
Thank you so much, Diana and Joy, for joining me here on Lake Effect. I really appreciate you both.
Thank you so much. It's been my joy to be here.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Diana and Joy are the hosts of the podcast Transparently Speaking. They spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang in August. If you want to hear the conversation with Bryce D. Smith and Laurie Cook Daniels about the Milwaukee Trans Oral History Project, you can find that at wuwm.com. Coming up after the break, we'll learn about two brick pillars on Milwaukee's east side.
I think I called them posts, but I don't know. They're just like sort of towers, brick towers. I don't know. I always just assumed that they were posts that held up gates.
Bubbler Talk is next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It's time now for the latest installment of our Bubbler Talk series. Lake Effect's Mallory Chang looks into two seemingly random brick pillars on Milwaukee's east side.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
Hi, I'm WUWM's Mallory Chang. For this week's Bubbler Talk, we received a question from listener Eric Wallach of Milwaukee, who asked about a pair of brick pillars at North Shepherd Avenue and East Locust Street on Milwaukee's east side.
I live over by UWM, so not too far from where those pillars are. I've been living in that neighborhood for probably about 12 years now, and I always kind of walk past them on my way to like Sendex or getting down to that Downers Avenue area. And, you know, just like, oh, that's kind of weird that there's these two pillars on the one end of the street and then two pillars on the other. And then when the pandemic hit, it's like I was walking a lot more. So I'd always walk by those like at least once or twice a day. I really want to know now what story is behind these kind of random looking pillars.
I did a little research about the plot of land, and it turns out the corner is owned by the city. I also found in my research that Bobby Tanzillo, a senior editor and writer at On Milwaukee, reported about these same structures. We met over Zoom, but as a true journalist, Bobby called me from the field sitting along one of the brick pillars. You're literally at Locust and Shepherd right now. So I just want to initially start. What did you think the pillars, the piles were? And what did you find out that the pillars or piles, I don't even know what to call them, these structures at Locust and Shepherd were?
I think I called them posts, but I don't know. They're just like sort of towers, brick towers. I don't know. I always just assumed that they were posts that held up gates, you know, that held gates, because I thought it was like a gated block, like an exclusive block at some point. And I came out here and I looked around and I realized, well, there's no hardware on them that would suggest gates were originally attached.
Bobby enlisted the help from a friend who had another theory. He believed that these were architectural follies or fake ruins. This was something wealthy people usually did and was a practice that dated back to 17th century England.
Rich folks who had these estates out in the country would build like fake crumbling medieval castles and things like that to make it look like they were living on a site filled with history.
With a bit more investigation, Bobby and his friend came across some city maps from the early 20th century.
He found a 1924 city street map that showed that they were here in 1924, and the block was being developed in the first couple of decades of the 20th century. And his theory, and I like his theory, is that they were built to make it seem like an exclusive block. So it had these things which didn't actually have gates, but looked like sort of a grander entrance into the street. So it was all sort of a way to kind of make it look different than the blocks around it and sort of give it a more unique and perhaps swanky look.
The Prospect Hill Development Company that built up the subdivision no longer exists. But then I started to think, if these pillars were located on city property, did that mean the city maintained the pillars? I called multiple departments at the city, ranging from permits to forestry, and I got an answer from Sherelle Taylor, a representative from the city's call center.
So I did speak to one of the supervisors in forestry who said that they do maintain the two lots across the street from each other. It's called Shepherd's Gate. So the city just maintains the grass, but the neighborhood association is actually responsible for the pillars.
I also heard back from Brian Deneve, who is a marketing and communications officer for the city. He let me know, in addition to mowing the grass, the sidewalks are cleared in the winter. And some work is done to clear the shrubs near the pillars, but only when it blocks the sidewalks. So the pillars may not serve any functional purpose, but hey, they're nice to look at.
They are part of sort of the character of the block at this point. So I would hope they'd stay just for that reason, because they are unique. They're just these kind of unique things. And there's stuff like this all over the city that I hope people kind of pay attention to and appreciate.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Landmark Credit Union and Palermo's Pizza. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit wuwm.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
Bubbler Talk is a regular series here on Lake Effect, and you can check it out every Monday at noon and 8 o'clock at night. You can also find our previous seasons of Bubbler Talk at wuwm.com. And that episode of Bubbler Talk wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being with us. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll speak with Maricha Harris about her new role as the executive director of the Dominican Center. Plus, our latest pandemic reflections focuses on a student who graduated high school and started college during the pandemic. That's tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.